From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Reagan Edelman. Recently on Undisciplined, we discussed the OSIRIS-REx mission, which came to a head with a landing out in Dugway in September of 2023. The spacecraft collected a sample of asteroid Bennu and brought it back to Earth for further study and research. The NASA mission sparked a lot of interest locally because it felt so close to home. The spacecraft has since been repurposed to the mission OSIRIS-APEX, which focuses on planetary defense by analyzing the asteroid Apophis and its close encounter with Earth. But funding for OSIRIS-APEX is at risk. And so is funding for a Mars sample return project, a mission to Venus, and the fully built and ready for launch Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope. The Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland, home to more than 10,000 civil servants and contractors, is also under threat, maybe facing partial or full closure. This is all due to proposed budget cuts. The Trump administration has proposed sweeping cuts to NASA's budget for the fiscal year 2026, with science programs bearing the brunt of the reductions. The administration is seeking an across-the-board 20% cut to the agency's total funding, roughly $5 billion from the $25 billion top line, and nearly all of that reduction is concentrated in NASA's Science Mission Directorate, which oversees critical areas like planetary science, Earth observation, astrophysics, and climate science. Right now, the NASA budget is only between 0.4% to 1% of federal spending. If this cut is enacted, the science division would see its budget slashed from $7.5 billion to just $3.9 billion, which is a nearly 50% cut to the science division. While the final budget must be approved by Congress, where opposition is expected, the administration may try to implement elements of the plan early, using procedural maneuvers if the formal budget is delayed past the October 1st start of the new fiscal year. For now, though, scientists, space advocates, and lawmakers are bracing for a battle over the future of NASA's science programs and America's role in space. And Christopher Koukinos is one of them. Christopher is a professor emeritus of English. He's a poet and an author or co-author of many books. His most recent is Still as Bright, an illuminating history of the moon from antiquity to tomorrow, which follows the history and science of the moon, but also serves as a memoir. Christopher has been outspoken about the importance of space exploration and the importance of NASA's budget. He also has said that this is a winnable battle. Christopher Koukinos, welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be on the show.
Christopher, let's start out by talking a little bit about you. You're a writer, a professor, but so much of your work has revolved around space. Was that the trajectory you expected to follow? Did you dream about space?
I did. You know, I had the childhood dreams that I think a lot of people do. And then that ran up against the reality of my not being very good at math. So I was literally yanked out of an advanced algebra class by my teacher, Miss Hawk. I've never forgotten that. And I still don't know if that was because I was goofing off or if I had screwed up a problem. But I turned to writing and in that process found, you know, real interest in the natural world. So I'd studied journalism, I studied poetry, and then found myself working on my first book, which was about extinct North American birds, and then another book about meteorites and a bunch of other projects. But yes, so that interest runs deep and really got sparked again, maybe in my late 20s and early 30s when I got a telescope. So I've had a real, you know, great career working on stories for, you know, LA Times, Esquire, a bunch of other places about space and space flight. And is that, you know, it's aspirational and it's inspirational. And that's one of the reasons why I think the White House budget proposal has really garnered as much opposition as it has so far.
Your most recent article is aptly titled "To Dumbly Go Where No Space Budget Has Gone Before," where you're discussing this proposed budget cut. As an avid space nerd, what did you feel when you saw that proposal?
I was shocked, actually, you know, and I think part of the reaction in the space community, which is, you know, largely nonpartisan. Space is a unifier. It's across the aisles. There's the Planetary Science Caucus in Congress. The Planetary Society, which has been leading the fight against this budget proposal, Jack Kierley and Casey Dreyer in particular, it's a nonpartisan advocacy group. And as Casey Dreyer points out, the proposal that came out of the White House actually undercuts President Trump's own interests, his own goals, both in this second term and from his first term. We could talk about the Artemis program, the human return to the moon. This White House budget proposal for the next fiscal year would actually, frankly, just cripple the Artemis program. And yet the Trump administration was the one that began the Artemis program. It was so popular in Congress and you know, in the space community, even with some of the questions people have about it, that the Biden administration continued it. So anyway, yeah, my response was, wow, this is worse than I expected.
So if these proposed cuts are to be implemented, what do you think are the most immediate and visible consequences for scientists, the public, and the space community?
Well, I think the most visible and immediate consequences for the public will be seeing cuts in earth science monitoring, climate science monitoring. We would see a further erosion of our understanding of extreme weather, for example. So a bunch of things will happen. And you know, we can talk about the larger sort of aspirational philosophical reasons why curiosity and science and how in space science is so valuable. But to put it in terms of just impact, for every dollar that is spent out of this NASA budget, again, about 0.3% of the federal budget, for every dollar, $3 comes back to the national economy. And that would affect Utah directly because of the Artemis program. So there would be a whole range of impacts if this proposal passes.
Something you've been rather outspoken about is the economic value of NASA, which while it spends a portion of the national budget, obviously, it's also generating a lot of revenue. And it's also creating a large job market.
Tens of thousands of jobs, about 300,000 jobs nationally as a result of NASA's investment. And again, just to put this in the context of the federal budget, the federal discretionary budget. So that's excluding Social Security and Medicaid and so forth, all of which is being discussed right now. But talking about the discretionary budget, which would be, you know, commerce, transportation, defense, and so forth, NASA occupies 0.3%. The budget proposal that came out of the White House, really from the Office of Management and Budget, and again, the suspicion in the space community is without the president really paying much attention to it, would return us to a pre-1961 level in real dollars, before we even flew an American in space. That is moving backwards. That is moving backwards. So here in Utah, we're talking about 1,600 jobs related to the moon program, the Artemis program. And so we're talking about not quite $400 million of economic output in Utah because of NASA.
You also mentioned in your article outsourcing talent and students losing opportunities, and that these cuts might shift the balance of global space leadership were they to happen. Do you think that this proposal could cause a long-term brain drain in United States science and engineering?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. The American Astronomical Society has said, you know, that this is their language. Without robust and sustained federal funding, the United States will lose at least a generation of talent to other countries. And that is, you know, that's just unacceptable. And so, you know, we're already seeing universities in Canada, in France, and other countries reach out to American scientists and researchers and say, come here. You know, so they're developing packages to bring American scientists overseas. The brain drain would be astonishing. And even again, if this proposal doesn't pass as it stands, there might be additional damage. And, you know, and already I've done some reporting for Scientific American and other venues on the morale at NASA. It's quite low. And we have an acting administrator who is proposing a 5,000 person reduction in force, layoffs and buyouts, essentially, along with reorganizing centers and reorganizing headquarters responsibilities. And it's not that change is bad. I mean, some of these things might be very beneficial. There's no question. But to have that happen in the context of this budget proposal sort of hanging over the agency and hanging over American leadership in space, it's disheartening to a lot of people in the space community. And there's a sense of fear also about not just the future of our programs in space, but people's livelihoods depend on this. So again, you know, tens and tens and tens of thousands of jobs in industry and small businesses, at NASA centers, at universities, these are all at risk right now.
If the research wasn't enough to be concerned about, if the economic value of the job market wasn't enough to be concerned about, there's another lens to this too. It's a hit for the nation as a whole for multiple reasons, like we've been mentioning, but there's this greater implication regarding security risks, national security risks too. Tell me about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I would come back to, you know, some of the things I've written about for the Salt Lake Tribune and the Los Angeles Times in trying to consider this proposal. And if we cede American leadership in space this easily, then we lose a number of assets. We lose missions. We lose engineers. We lose researchers. And those people go somewhere, and there's, you know, a good chance that American leadership in science turns into our being a kind of backwater. There's one other point I would make here, too, which is the United States NASA administrator under President Trump in his first administration, Jim Bridenstine, is a Republican congressman from Oklahoma. There was a lot of skepticism about his appointment. He proved to be an absolutely stellar administrator, in large part because he knew Congress and he knew diplomacy. He knew how to make deals. And it was under his leadership and under the Space Council leadership of Vice President Pence that the Artemis Accords began. This is more than 50 partner countries working with the U.S. and NASA on our return to the moon program. What happens to that? If this budget proposal passes, that coalition probably just dissipates. So we would lose a lot of valuable diplomatic alliances as a result of this budget proposal if it passes.
Let's talk a little bit about that program. You mentioned earlier that these budget cuts go directly against President Trump's original plans to get Americans back into space, back onto the moon. Why has that shifted?
I think the finger points at the Office of Management and Budget. And putting a proposal in place that for whatever reason, other people in the administration, the president himself, didn't pay that close attention to. So I'm hoping that there are people around him who are saying, "Look, you know, if this passes, the program that you started will really effectively end after just a couple flights." So Artemis 1 flew 2 years ago. That was a test mission, and the launch vehicle, which admittedly has been over budget and has been delayed, nonetheless worked. We have a flyby scheduled for early next year with humans on board, an amazing crew. I've been privileged to talk with them. They are going to be the first humans to return to lunar space in more than 50 years. All that's to say, the program is in the pipeline. There are complexities. There's an architecture already built, and there are people already working on this. Metal has been bent. Materials are, you know, being manufactured right now. It would make absolutely no sense in all of these reasons, including budgetary reasons, for the Artemis program to stop after just two flights.
I think that the Artemis program is also super powerful in the sense that it can get people invested in science again, get people invested in space. I was about 10 years old when the shuttle program ended. With the Atlantis trip in 2011. And I remember feeling absolutely devastated that that was over. It seemed to me like space was completely out of reach again and that it was just over, which might have been a bit of a 10-year-old dramatic reaction. But I do think that some of that wonder and some of that excitement comes back with the potential of sending regular humans, regular astronauts back and giving them those opportunities. It's a really powerful idea.
I agree. And I'm the oldest person in the room. I watched the Apollo 11 landing. I was 6 years old and it was deeply inspirational. It still inspires me. Apollo was a unique moment. Like, we're not going to get that moment back. The politics are very different, but the inspirational aspect of human spaceflight cannot be underestimated. You know, kids make decisions to go to school, to become scientists, become engineers, to become pilots because of programs like this. So there is that. And there's also the fact that the moon, having written about it, I look at it through my telescope. I think it's a beautiful landscape. It's weird and wild and dramatic. And it has a lot still to teach us. So when people say, well, we've already been to the moon, why go back? It's like, well, that's like saying, I was in Europe for a 2-week vacation. I've been to Earth. I know what it's like. The moon has a lot of secrets yet to tell us about the origin of the solar system, the possibility of being a platform for really interesting science. It has the potential to give us the kind of test bed that we need if we're serious about going to Mars. And so this notion that has been out there a little bit, that this budget proposal actually gets us to Mars faster, I think that's just a complete fallacy. Space is hard. Going to the moon is hard. Even going back to the moon is hard. Going to Mars is exponentially more difficult. We need to prove technologies. We need to understand the behavior of human physiology in a deep space environment for long duration, periods. We can do that around the moon.
You mentioned climate science earlier. Our host, Matthew, is a climate scientist himself. We've constantly been talking about climate change and climate science on our show for the past several months. And you mentioned a big chunk of this budget could impact spending on climate science research. I think a big problem that we face already is a large avoidance of admitting that climate change is real. Even the vernacular we use has shifted, right? Like, climate change sounds a lot less alarming than global warming. Do you think that this move, if it were to happen, this move to have less climate science research is going to further that gap in understanding the climate crisis we're in? And do you think that's part of the purpose?
Oh, sure. Yes, I agree. Yes, both. Yes, it is. There is a segment that is engaged in active climate denialism. I think that wing is shrinking. And, I need look only at Senator John Curtis here in Utah, who has been part of a Republican effort to tackle climate issues, and to his credit. And I think if you get a lot of people behind closed doors, they will say, yeah, this is real. I mean, the science behind the general point of climate change, that human activity is increasing the average temperature of the planet and the average temperature of the atmosphere and the oceans, and having a number of effects, including extreme weather and drought and so forth, more extreme climate events, more extreme storms, unpredictability. That science is unassailable. So in a sense, that ship has already sailed. So I think of this budget proposal, again, coming from someone who is in that wing of deny and deflect when it comes not just to climate science, but science in general. I would say 15th century attitude toward the natural world and the human relationship to it. That's where that's coming from. And, I'm glad that that is an increasingly smaller fraction. Now, having said that, it's still a dangerous trend, and there's no doubt that this is part of what's going on. The piece I did for Scientific American was on the eviction of the Goddard Institute for Space Sciences. They were with just basically a month's notice, no reason whatsoever, absolutely no budget savings. It's actually costing taxpayers more. A group of researchers and laboratory equipment and library and so forth, housed in a building in New York City, a NASA center, and they were evicted and just dispersed to other places with very little notice. That's largely because they did climate research there. So that's one of the disheartening aspects of this. But again, I want to end on a hopeful note. I feel like Congress is being persuaded right now that this NASA budget proposal is a bad idea. And if we can win this fight on behalf of the agency, on behalf of science, on behalf of the astronauts who are getting ready to go to the moon, then I think that bodes well for staving off any other bad ideas with American leadership in space science.
And ultimately, you do call this a winnable battle. I think it's easy to feel overwhelmed by some of the decisions that are taking place that feel out of our reach. But you, like you said, it's important to view it from a hopeful side as well. And you say this is a winnable battle, but how can somebody like me or you or our listeners make a difference?
Well, it is absolutely a winnable battle. And I would turn to the Planetary Society. I'm not trying to turn this into an advertisement for them, but they are the leading space advocacy group in the country. And they have taken the lead on this. They have sent a petition to Congress with tens of thousands of signatures representing every congressional district in the country except one, has 2 million followers globally. So I would go to planetary.org/save-NASA-science. So just go to planetary.org and you're going to find resources there. And even just as simple as a quick phone call to your senators, to your representatives saying, hey, I'm concerned about this. I think this is a bad idea. They pay attention to this. And that's why it is a winnable battle. We do feel overwhelmed, but I think we often forget that making that phone call, sending in an email, dropping into an office, if you happen to be able to do that, where there's a field office for an elected representative, they pay attention to those things.
One of the more common arguments for the few that are supportive of cutting the budget, I think, are those who say that space exploration is a luxury, particularly in times of economic and political hardship. What do you think about that? I feel like that ties in really well with everything that you just said about the inspiring aspects of going to space, about the important research that's still to be done, and also about how unifying it is to accomplish missions like that.
Yeah, and it's an understandable argument. And again, if you look at the sliver of spending, when you talk about, you know, X billions of dollars here, billions of dollars there, right? That's a lot of money. But in the scope of the federal budget, we're talking about less than a half of a percent. So NASA does not take up that much room and yet has all of these positive consequences. And we choose to go to space. And you know, humans and probes. And we pursue this knowledge because of our curiosity. Like, we evolved to be a curious species. And so we explore other worlds to know those worlds. And that's how we discover more about ourselves. That sounds abstract and poetic, and maybe it is. But I think it bears sort of repeating that curiosity is a virtue. And pursuing curiosity scientifically is a virtue. We need governments to put projects together, not just for space, but you know, other research in diseases and in energy development, all of these things. That's a civic responsibility. The last thing I would say about this is that we have the wealth in this country to do a lot of different things. And I think that the old argument that we have to solve everything here on Earth first runs against human nature, for one, and ignores the fact that solving for space helps solve for Earth. So I think we can do all these things.
You end the article with this really, I think, quite beautiful and humanistic thought about why we explore, why we choose to go to space.
Yeah,
I think it's a very fitting conclusion to such a passionate piece. Christopher, what does this exploration mean to you? Why must we continue to explore?
If we do not explore, we are choosing to become individuals and cultures and societies and a species that values a kind of false security over asking questions and getting answers that are inspiring and sometimes discomforting. So that's why we choose to go to space, to, again, pursuing knowledge, because we evolved to be curious species. We would not be here without curiosity. So if we decide as a country that we're not going to explore other worlds, that we're not going to know them, that we're not going to discover more about who we are, that we're going to sort of close in and close ranks and live a life of kind of I think, fearful comfort that is actually ultimately insecure. If that's what we choose to do, then I will be profoundly disappointed. But at every sort of moment in American history, when we have faced these kinds of questions, I think we've actually chosen the path of light over darkness, the path of curiosity and adventure, the adventure of ideas. And so I believe that we'll be able to do that again.
That's Christopher Koukinos. Christopher is a professor emeritus of English. He is a poet and an author or co-author of many books. His most recent is Still as Bright, an illuminating history of the moon from antiquity to tomorrow. Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio, and if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us then, you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University and from listeners like you. You can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our executive producer is Matthew Lamont. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot, and I'm Reagan Edelman. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.